From high atop Feibusch Media World Headquarters in unusually warm Rochester, New York, it's the Top of the Tower podcast. I'm your host, Scott Feibusch. We are brought to you this week by Shively Labs. Shively Labs is a division of Howell Laboratories. Shively is a proud employee-owned company with over 50 years of expert antenna and filter design and manufacturing. Our thanks to Shively and all of our sponsors for their support. A lot to talk about on this edition of Top of the Tower. We are going to hear more interviews from the floor of the radio show that just wrapped up a couple of weeks ago in Orlando, get some input from some of the folks who were on the floor about what they're thinking about the state of the industry right now. We are, of course, keeping an eye on what's happening to the south of us in Florida and along the coast as Hurricane Michael made its landfall. Just this afternoon, we are still getting word about some of the damage to broadcasters down there. In particular, it sounds like the TV station in Panama City Beach, WJHG-TV, at least lost a studio transmitter link tower that I believe also had an FM broadcast site on it. So we're going to try to get some updates on that, and we will bring those to you as we get them. We begin, however, this week with the FCC's latest notice of proposed rulemaking on what is called AM revitalization. And we'll get out of the way right now the idea that, no, this is not necessarily ultimately a proceeding to try to make the AM band as vital as it once was. That probably is a fool's errand at this point. Perhaps you can think of it as a misnomer and that it's actually revitalization for the broadcasters who are doing things on AM radio. I am a very firm believer in the idea that what it's all about in the end is content more so than platform. And you know, if you were on the Gulf Coast as the hurricane was approaching, especially if you were in the Panama City area, the odds are pretty good that you would have gotten your best service in this particular case from FM radio. The big FM station there is owned by iHeart. It's a station called WPAP 92.5. Normally they are a music station, but boy, when there is an emergency, that is the station that has built up the image in the market as being the place to go for information. They stayed on the air. They've got a phenomenal engineer down there, my friend Charlie Wooten, a great engineer who has been working nonstop with the approach of this storm to get everything ready, to be prepared, to keep that radio station on the air. And as best we can tell, that radio station stayed on the air. It helped in this case. You know, again, corporate ownership is not automatically a bad thing because they had the resources of iHeart at their disposal. They were able to actually draw in help from other clusters, in particular to broadcast from Tallahassee, which wasn't hit quite as badly, and keep programming going from there when they couldn't necessarily stay in the studio in Panama City. And so in this case, it happened to be an FM station that was there to provide. There are other markets, certainly, where you would still go to AM first for that. If you were in Boston, if you were in Buffalo, if you were in Chicago or Milwaukee, you probably would go first to one of the Heritage AM stations. But in that particular market, it happens to be FM. So what is the FCC rather proposing right now, and what is it they are seeking comment on, and why do I think it is so important that if you're listening to this and you have an opinion, that you should weigh in with a comment? Well, it's a notice of proposed rulemaking. In this case, a further notice of proposed rulemaking, because they have already done some things with the so-called AM revitalization proceeding, including all these translators that AM stations are getting on the FM band. And in this particular chapter, which we had heard rumors of when we were at the show in Orlando, that there was something coming very soon that had been on circulation amongst the commissioners, they are now proposing to change some of the rules for the way that AM stations are allocated and can interfere with one another. So for the first time in this, we are getting rules that are specific to the AM radio dial. What they are proposing primarily concerns the Class A radio stations. These are what we once called the clear channel, lowercase c on both counts, radio stations that broadcast for the most part with 50,000 watts of power, that broadcast for the most part at the low end of the dial, although there are a few up in the 1500s also. These are the stations once upon a time that were designated Class 1A and Class 1B. So you've got stations like KFI in Los Angeles, like WBBM and WSCR in Chicago, my WBZ in Boston that is near and dear to my heart, WHAM here in Rochester, WCCO in Minneapolis. You all know what these radio stations are. These are stations that up until now have had considerable amount of protection against interference, not only to their ground wave signal, but also to the sky wave signal that goes out from their towers up into the ionosphere, bounces back down in other places at night. And until now, there has been a considerable amount of protection that these stations have gotten for that sky wave signal, which means that if you had been, let's say, a daytimer operating on 660 in Greenville, South Carolina, or operating on 890 in Atlanta, Georgia, or operating on 640 in Iowa, that there were a lot of limitations that you had on your ability to operate at night, because at night those frequencies were primarily reserved for the big gun on that channel, for the big Class A, quote, clear channel, unquote, radio station. Now the FCC is proposing to modify that. And what they want to do is to allow these secondary stations to have more power at night, by reducing the amount of protection that the big Class A stations have down to just still a considerable amount, but still basically to ground wave protection. There are also some changes that are being proposed in the rules for adjacent channel protection on AM, so that it changes. It goes back actually an older set of rules about what the overlapping contours that are allowed for ground wave protection on those adjacent channels. But the big focus right now is really on this Class A ruling. And there are a couple of different ways to look at it. There is a school of thought that has plenty of legitimacy behind it that looks at it this way, that says, okay, you know what? In the real world of 2018, there are no longer very many listeners who are deriving primary radio service, who are getting the bulk of their useful radio service by tuning into a skywave signal that could be coming from 600 or 800 miles away. You hear people kick around the number 750 miles. That's not actually written into the FCC rules. That's an approximation of what the current skywave protection is. There's nowhere that actually right now says 750 miles. There won't be in the new rules either. But there's this argument that says that, you know what, nobody who is driving around in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., is actively trying to listen to WLS out of Chicago to get information that they need at night. They have plenty of local stations that they can listen to. They have an FM dial in most places that is full of stations. And in any event, and this is another big piece of the argument, there's nothing that a lot of these stations are doing at night that isn't being replicated locally. If WLS at night is running Red Eye Radio, there's a station probably much closer to you that is also running Red Eye Radio or is running ESPN or Fox Sports or Coast to Coast AM or whatever else is occupying those nighttime hours. It is no longer essential that you be able to receive WLS over a huge chunk of the central U.S. because it's your only source of Blue Network programming, as it was once upon a time. Actually, it's WENR. I digress. So there's that very valid argument. I can understand where that's coming from. I can pretty much agree with it. There is a piece of it that then further seeks to denigrate anybody who cares about this reception as being some kind of out-of-touch, aging DX hobbyist. I think that's probably a little unnecessarily nasty to the people who still actually care about listening to distant stations, and I'll explain why in a minute. So that's a piece of it. There is a counter-argument to that that says, wait a minute, there are actually still parts of the country where there isn't reliable 24-hour local service from stations, where you can't hear very much on a local dial at night, where you can't hear anything that's necessarily actually programming local news or even national news at night that would be a source of emergency information if you needed it. And there are, believe it or not, and it's hard for those of us who live in the East to remember, there are big swaths of the country where you can still drive around and you're not near a local FM or even AM station, where you are not necessarily within range of a reliable wireless internet or broadband signal. So you can't just say, as easy as it is for a lot of us, you can't just say, well, you know, just kick up TuneIn Radio on your phone or iHeartRadio.com and just stream the station that you want. Because believe it or not, there are still parts of the country where you can be driving around and you still don't have the luxury of doing that. There is a further piece of this argument. My friend Michelle Bradley at Rec Networks has made this too, that says, you know what, you can't assume that a service you have to pay for, like wireless broadband or like satellite radio, can be a substitute for everybody for the public service that is provided by free over-the-air radio. So these are where some of these pieces start to intersect. There is another piece of this argument. This, I think, when it comes time to really be writing this up, and believe me, I'm going to be making comments to the FCC on this just as I have in the past. There's another piece of this that I think gets neglected, because it's very easy on the one hand to say from a theoretical point of view, from a real life use case point of view, from a business point of view, that yeah, nobody is making money if you're selling ad time on WSCR in Chicago. You're not, well, first of all, you're not making a lot of money at night anyway, but you're not making money at night out of somebody who is listening to a game coverage or is listening to your talk show from somewhere in North Carolina or from somewhere in Nebraska. It's just not a source of revenue. It's not really a source of ratings. We know, because we can see now in the ratings books, that in markets where people fill out diaries, there is very little listening in those kind of markets to big signals that are coming in from out of town. So we can accept that this is something that is easing its way into the past. However, and here's where we come back to my friends, the DXers, and I am one. I will happily drive around at night, tooling around the AM dial in strange parts of the country just to see what I can pick up that I wouldn't be expecting to pick up. Well, what do we learn from the DXers? I am a member of a whole bunch of online groups that present DX reports that people contribute, you know, day in and day out from around the country. And let me tell you, if somebody is operating at night when they're not supposed to be on one of these big, quote, clear channel, unquote, frequencies, the DXers notice it right away because it is screamingly obvious. It does not take a lot of power on one of these channels to create interference from a large distance away. Case in point. Lance Venta from Radio Insight and I were driving around Georgia after the radio show a couple of weeks ago. We spent a night on the outskirts of Savannah, Georgia, which is a great city. You should go there. It's eat the low country shrimp boil. It was delicious. Again, I digress. I got in the car early the morning that we were leaving and decided to drive around, go get a bunch of pictures of tower sites that will eventually show up over on Tower Site of the Week. And I start poking around the AM dial because I've never been in Savannah before, and I'm curious to see, okay, what's coming in from where? What can I hear? And I end up on the expanded part of the AM dial, up above 1600, and I'm tuning around, and there's a really strong signal playing R&B music and gospel on 1680. There's somebody else playing rock and roll on 1660, and I'm kind of mentally reviewing the dial in my head, and I'm saying, these aren't stations that are anywhere near Savannah, Georgia. What's going on here? And I kept listening a little bit, and we're in the 8 o'clock hour here, so it's not long past sunrise. It's in what you would still call critical hours. There's still some sky wave going on. And I start listening to 1660, and all of a sudden the announcement comes on. You're listening to 94.7 Smoke. Well, that's Charlotte, North Carolina. That's, you know, 300, 400 miles away. And then I tune over to 1680. And it's Winter Garden, Orlando, Florida, and that's another 300, 400 miles away, and I know because I just made that drive a couple of days before. So, you know, I'm well aware that these signals are coming in with not a lot of power at this point, either 1,000 or 10,000 watts, but there's nothing else on the channel. And the point that I'm making here is that medium wave is very much unlike a lot of the rest of the dial. If you are on FM radio, if I'm running a radio station here in Rochester, New York on 88.5, I don't care how much power you're putting on the radio dial in Washington, D.C. or in Columbus, Ohio at 88.5 on the dial. There is no amount of power. You could run a 320,000-watt superpower grandfathered station on that channel. And it doesn't matter because 51 weeks out of the year, that signal is never going to get over the horizon. It is never going to take a straight line path, and it is never going to interfere with my 88.5. It is never going to contribute to a noise floor or to cluttering the dial where I am here in my market. There will be occasions, and again, we know this because the DXers are really good at knowing this, and you should listen to them. We know that for, you know, maybe a week or two out of the year, especially in the early summer, that there is going to be e-skip that might bring 88.5 from Tampa, Florida, let's say, up, and it's just going to overwhelm me. And you know what? That's the way the ionosphere works, and there is nothing whatsoever you can do about it. But for 51 weeks out of the year, you can put 88.5 in a whole bunch of other places, and if it doesn't see past the horizon, it's not a problem for anybody. It's just there. It does its thing. I do my thing. You can make the argument that you can fill the dial so full in a market that stations locally interfere with one another, or that you can't hear things that are nearby in the next market over, and that's a separate argument. But again, there is no amount of stuff that you can put onto the VHF FM dial that you can put on UHF TV that's going to have much of an impact once you get across the horizon, once you get past 150, 200 miles. Medium wave is different. And we have been trying for nearly a century now to come up with ways to make it not be different, but it's different. If I am running a station, let's say on 1370 in Rochester, New York, and I'm putting out 5,000 watts, and I've got a directional pattern that's got some nulls in it, and I start driving into one of those nulls, if you put a 1370 on the air near Washington, D.C., and you make it non-directional, I guarantee you, after dark, that will contribute to my noise floor on 1370 here in Rochester. It will contribute to the noise floor under 1370 in Manchester, New Hampshire. It will contribute to the noise floor under 1370 in Toledo, Ohio, and so on and so on and so on. And all of these add up, and the more of them you put on, the more of them contribute to raising noise floor pretty much anywhere after dark, because that's the nature of the ionosphere. What you put on goes into it, and it goes just about everywhere. And again, you know, every antenna design under the sun has been tried to mitigate sky wave. The laws of physics are what they are. You can't do it. The laws of physics dictate that if you put a signal on the air, even a relatively low power one, that it is going to create new interference in other places. So let's look at what this does on these Class A clear channel frequencies. If you, for instance, have a station on 760 and you are in, let's say, northern New York up by the Canadian border, again, there is a real use case up there. It's a real station, WCHP. I guarantee you that a little bit before sunset on most nights, and especially in the winter when we're talking now about 3:30 in the afternoon, that you will start hearing WJR in Detroit, because WJR in Detroit is a 50,000-watt, non-directional, former Class 1A, clear-channel radio station. And its signal goes everywhere, not just all over Detroit and all over eastern Michigan, but everywhere. So the reality of life, if you are this radio station up in northern New York, or if you are a 760 in central Massachusetts, let's say, or what have you, the reality is that you are going to be getting this incoming interference. If you, let's say, as some people do, suggest, well, okay, let's cut WJR then back. They don't need that much power to serve their market. Well, here's where we run into another problem with reality. Because the reality for WJR is that as a result of having that enormous 50,000-watt clear channel signal, they have remained the success story, or at least one of a couple of success stories, on the AM radio dial in Detroit. Because they have that much power, their ground wave signal over Metro Detroit covers all of Metro Detroit in a way that most Detroit AM signals don't. You can drive west from downtown Detroit on I-94, and you can hang on to that WJR signal loud and clear and listenable out to the edge of the Detroit market, and then out into Ann Arbor, and you can keep it going out into Jackson and beyond that. But the point is, it covers all of Detroit. You can drive north, and you can take it all the way up into, you know, beyond the Wayne County line and into Macomb County, and up towards Port Huron. You can take it north up to Flint. You can take it south down towards Monroe. Anywhere you go in Detroit, you can hear WJR. If you start dialing back on that 50,000 watts of power, you quickly start getting additive interference underneath it, because you are using that 50,000 watts of power to overcome, to blank out noise from anything else that might be coming in on 760, or in some cases even adjacent channel noise from 750 or 770, and especially if they're running HD digital, which again is a whole other story. You need that level of power. If you are WJR, you need it to be able to cover the whole Detroit market and still be a success story on the AM dial and still be the place that people are going to go to if there is a storm or if there is a tragedy or if they need news or if they need information. It is no different if you are WGN in Chicago. Believe me, I was driving around Chicago this summer. Even those big 50,000-watt signals have trouble penetrating in a lot of places over the rising noise floor. You need every one of those 50,000 watts. If you start putting signals on, well, let's back up. If you, first of all, turn that down, you may reduce sky waves somewhat going in other directions, but you're not reducing it as much as you may think you're reducing it. And so that sky wave still is going to be there. You're not getting rid of it. You're reducing it a little, but you're not getting rid of it. You're not clearing things out enough for a station on 760 in northern New York or a station on 760 in Massachusetts to have really useful broad area, full market coverage, nighttime service, because that sky wave is still coming in from the big station somewhere else. If you start reducing power on a big 50,000-watt AM, and especially if you start putting other signals on that frequency, you then start eating into it in the edges, not in distant areas, not in the places where you can rationally look at it and say, you know what, does it matter anymore if you can't hear WJR over on the other side of the state in Grand Rapids? Does it matter if you can't hear it 200 miles away in Cleveland? I'm talking about within the local market, within the area where people are carrying ratings meters and where they are expecting to be able to turn on a radio and hear their local station strongly, you will begin creating new additive interference underneath those local signals. All of a sudden, WJR becomes hard to hear in suburban Macomb County. All of a sudden, KNX becomes even harder to hear down into Orange County or up into the northern reaches of LA County. All of a sudden, WBZ, and this is an absolute real-world example, no longer becomes the station that can be heard across the entire Boston market, and it's the only AM station that can boast that day and night. But all of a sudden, you may get out past Framingham, or you may get down south of Brockton, or you may get up on the North Shore and find, hey, there's this other 1030 that's starting to interfere with it. So here's the question that I ask then as I really begin to think about this and approach this. The question is, what value do you then get from allowing that to happen? Because there is going to be a measurable amount of reduction to the useful level of signal within a local station's market. And so is it worth it to say, okay, you know what, some other station somewhere else might be able to get a little bit of power out of this. And yeah, it's nice to believe that there is, you know, a local operator in every market who is ready to be there when the train derails at 2 in the morning and starts leaking toxic gas, or who's ready to be there when the tornado comes through on a weekend. But the reality is, as you know, if you travel around these markets, and I know because I travel around these markets, sure, these guys exist. You can find examples of them here and there. But they're not as prevalent as they once used to be. You know, if you can argue that the DX listener who is still tuning in at night to hear the talk show from WCCO, and they're listening in southern Iowa, you know, if that is sort of a thing of the past now for a lot of people, well, it's also a thing of the past to believe that in that small town in southern Iowa, that there is somebody local there who's got the staff and the resources to be there for every emergency and to make enough use out of this night power that it's really going to save what they're doing too. Which is to say, I think we have to be careful, and I think that we have to be extremely cautious in taking away the thing that we know works, because we know that for not all, but many of these large Class A stations, their signals and their heritage still draws listeners, still draws a local audience that you can definitely point to and say, hey, here is an existing AM radio success story that may be on a slow downward trend, but it still has some good years of life left in it. If you're ready to say we need to get rid of that, you better have a really good counterexample to say, okay, here's what you really are going to get in return. Because we've seen too many examples with things like the expanded band on AM, And even with some of these, not all again, but with some of these translators for AM stations on FM, where you're not necessarily getting public service out of it, but you're just getting additional automation on the dial. You're getting additional stations. And again, I heard a bunch of these on this trip through Georgia and Florida, you know, where you're getting stations that are barely on the air, that have low modulation, maybe the ground system failed, there's no ID at the top of the hour, there's a hum under the audio, there's double audio, and nobody's listening and nobody cares. Is it worth putting more of those on the air? And there's one more question that I'm going to be asking the FCC, too, to consider, and that's the question of how many stations that could potentially benefit from this in 2018 are really going to make the sizable investment that it would probably take to actually get this new power. I'm not speaking here for anybody but myself. I'm not speaking for any of my clients or for my sponsors. But I have informally surveyed some of the stations that I work with. And it's a wide range from stations in larger markets to stations in much smaller markets. And the consensus for most of them is that even if the FCC came to them tomorrow and said, you know what, you have the opportunity now to add more night power on this frequency where maybe you're getting interference already at critical hours or with the flea power that we allow you to use after sunset, a lot of them would think very hard about whether it's worth the investment right now to go and do that. At the very least, even in the very simplest case where you have a station that's non-directional, that perhaps has been a daytimer, and that could add some power at night simply by reprogramming the remote control and letting their existing day transmitters stay on at power after dark. Even in that case, there are still expenses just in the FCC filings and the showings that are going to have to be made on that. That alone will run at least several thousand dollars for any station that is considering doing it. If it takes more than that, if it involves reconfiguring a directional array, if it involves rebuilding a phaser, if it involves potentially reworking a ground system, or God forbid, adding a new tower or two, you know, now you're getting into five or even six figures. And again, the question you have to ask is, okay, just because the FCC says stations can do this, how many of them will see a return on that investment? And again, the word that I hear from my clients is that for a lot of them, investing anything in AM radio right now really is just a wash for them at night, that it is just not worth putting any more money into this, especially for the ones, there's a certain subset that are up on the top of the dial in the 1500s, where there are clear channel Class A stations that in some cases are within a few hundred miles that have just massive skywave that comes in some cases, not just overnight and critical hours, but well into the daylight hours and just pounds them. Where once some of these stations get translators, they don't want to have anything to do with AM anymore. So I think the question you also have to ask for the FCC is there really a base of stations that not only thinks this is a good idea theoretically, but believes that it will be a good idea practically to get this power and to put it on? So again, I'm not saying that there isn't a good case to be made, that there are good local stations that deserve an opportunity to provide more of this service at night. I'm not saying that there aren't stations that have the programming in place and that have the staff in place and that have the commitment from their owners. But I think we have to be extremely, extremely conscious of what the laws of the physics really are. We have to be extremely conscious of what the realities on all sides of this really are. I think we have to stay away from some of these easy stereotypes about, you know, who does or doesn't still use this service at night. And most importantly, I think it's sort of a Hippocratic oath of radio at this point. If it's not broken and we break it, there's going to be no way to fix it. If there is still value out there to these Skywave audiences and to the Skywave public service, and especially out west and in the Midwest, where there are still areas where it really is kind of the only free service that's available out there, I think we have to take a do-no-harm approach. And if there's any danger that that's going to get disrupted, I think maybe we have to say, you know what, this is a good place to just let this be for as long as it is. And even if it's not forever, even if the horizon on it is only 15 or 20 years, let's not kill it before it's time, especially if we're not going to get as much benefit as we think out of the other end of this. So that's it for my rant. The important thing out of this to remember is that this is a public comment proceeding, which means the FCC really does want to hear from you. They don't necessarily want to just hear unsupported rants, but they definitely want to hear from you if you're a listener who either depends on a local station for which you would like to see it get more power at night on AM, or if you are somebody who depends on Skywave service and doesn't want to see it get disrupted. They want to know that you're out there. If you have some actual observations that you can contribute, they want to hear from you. I don't think that these what they've proposed in the NPRM is anywhere near a done deal, depending on what kind of response they get. I know, for instance, the emergency alerting community, which has been very active in this, has kind of had their ears prick up as a result of all of this. And I know there are conference calls that are going on right now wherein they're discussing what sort of response they're going to submit. And I expect it will be very much in favor of keeping interference levels low under these Class A stations and making sure that they can still be heard over wide areas. And I think the FCC will listen to that. So I will be posting a link on the show page as to where you can submit your contributions. It's not hard to do. The FCC really wants to hear from you on this. So if I can implore you at all, whatever your views are on this, especially if you disagree on me, if you disagree with me, make your voices heard. Get it out there. Let's get the FCC as much good input as we can so that they can make the best decision that they can. All right. Enough with what's going on with that right now. Back to the radio show in Orlando. And on the last afternoon before I left, I realized that there was a very familiar face on the floor there who I might not be seeing again very soon at a convention. And that, of course, my good friend Gary Liebisch, who has a long history both engineering around me here in upstate New York, and then working in broadcast sales for a variety of employers in recent years, and most recently Nautel, which is where he was working what I believe was his last NAB show before retirement. So I had a chance to pull him outside during convention breakdown and get a chance to talk to him a little bit about his experiences and his career and his legacy. Gary Liebisch of Nautel, we hear the noises behind us of the show being broken down. How did it go for you?
Went real well. We had a good crowd. We've always had a really good customer base in Florida, and a lot of the people drove in for here from the southeast, and I was very happy with the attendance here today.
You've done enough of these over the years.
Yeah, I've lost count. I keep all the badges. I have a collection of the badges back home in the office, so done quite a few.
What's big for you guys this year?
Basically, we're still showing our relatively new importer-exporter, which kind of lowers the cost of entry into HD radio for a lot of stations. And, of course, our mainstays are still our VS transmitters and GV, and, we're doing a good amount of AM business still as well.
I know I've done a bunch of translator projects with a lot of your smaller stuff lately.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
The number of VS300s that I've specced out.
Still a lot of translator activity.
Where are we now sort of in the life cycle of HD radio? A lot of the first generation stuff, I'm guessing, is probably out of the field now or getting relegated to backup use?
Yeah, I think as stations replace their hardware that's approaching 20 years old, what we see is that HD upgrades take place almost entirely coincident with replacing the main transmitter. So it's a lot more justifiable now. Instead of doing just a standalone HD conversion and trying to justify that, it's time to replace the main transmitter, and so at least the HD capability tends to go with that. And along with that, then the higher injection, which came out about in 2010. So, we're seeing a lot of that happen as well.
In terms of being able to manage the technology, I know in terms of being able to do things like time alignment, which always used to be such a bear, I think that problem at this point is
solved. Much more under control in terms of, a lot of the people on the peripheral end that are doing receivers are making interfaces now that make it a lot easier for time alignment to be self-correcting now instead of it being the manual process that it had been.
Over at Wheatstone, and their new processor includes a built-in receiver for time alignment.
I heard that the other night, that they had the new X4 that they had, and the fact that it's got a receiver in there, and you can actually decode the HD and make parameter adjustments based on an actual decoded HD signal. That's a unique approach.
I'm disappointed that I'm not going to make it to Wisconsin for the Broadcasters Clinic. Don Backus was telling me that
going to be a little debate going on there between water cooling on his side or liquid cooling on his side and, yeah. and air cooling on yours. You're still committed to the traditional air-cooled architecture?
Well, we acknowledge that there is a place for liquid cooling in the marketplace, and there's a place for traditional air-cooled, and every situation is different. Obviously, in the warmer climates, the liquid cooling can be better justified, but on the other side of the equation, of course, that comes at a higher price. So, you know, we think both technologies will coexist for a while.
Especially at lower power levels, like
sure,
a lot of the stuff
yeah,
that
yeah.
you guys do so well.
Right, yeah.
It's the state of the AM market right now. You guys are kind of the player out there right now.
And, you know, the work that we have done internationally in high power, you know, I've been doing SPE presentations for several months now about the 2 megawatt that we did in Hungary. And the work that we've done in that market has enabled us to stay in the domestic AM market, despite the fact that there's not a whole lot of growth in that market right here now. But the work that we do internationally in high power AM is what keeps us in that business. And so, you know, certainly we're glad to have the... a good share of the AM market in the U.S. now, but what really keeps us going is the fact that internationally high power is still a very big deal in a lot of countries like the Middle East and Western Europe in the case of Hungary.
So for those of us who haven't gotten a chance to see that presentation yet, yeah. 2 megawatts?
2 megawatts, yeah. Yeah, basically it's 5 400-kilowatt transmitters into a five-port combiner. And it was done in Hungary for Antenna Hungaria, and it was commissioned and went on the air just about a year ago.
And probably in the same space that an old Western Electric 50 would have taken up.
Yeah, well, actually, that's true. The old Russian transmitter that they took out of service is just as interesting as the one that we put in, because that was a monster as well.
Yeah. I want to see that presentation at some point.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'd be glad to share it.
So for all of the NABs that you have been at, this is the last one?
Yeah, this is the last one. I've got another Ohio show to do in a couple of months, but I'm hanging it up at the end of the year. So, you know, it's kind of a melancholy moment, you know, and the fact that I've certainly made a lot of friends in the industry who hopefully I'll stay in touch with. I'll probably still keep one foot in the industry in one way or another. I'd like to figure out a way to come to a show in the future, but, you know, we'll see. But
I have a feeling somebody will have a space for you somewhere.
Yeah, I'm going to be involved in some local radio in my home market of Columbus, and in that way, hopefully, I'll be able to get my hands in a number of things from time to time, so not going to disappear entirely.
What else besides radio is in your plans now?
Well, you know, my hobbies are ham radio and O-gauge model railroading. And my wife and I plan to do some traveling and spending more time with the grandkids. So I expect to keep busy.
How many years now have you been in this?
You know, coming up at the end of October, I will have been in the business for 50 years, counting the time that I started at my college station at WRPI in Troy, New York. It'll be 50 years at the end of October, so it's kind of a nice... nice timing to be able to be going out on sort of an anniversary of when I came in.
Look, somebody should have had a ceremony or something for you here.
That's all right. We don't want to celebrate old.
Congratulations.
Thank
and good
you.
Luck.
Thank you.
And we have still more conversations from the show Florida Orlando that we will be bringing you on the podcast next week and the weeks to follow. Of course, I am going to be in New York City next week, and the podcast will be coming to you from the floor of the Audio Engineering Society and the NAB New York shows, which again this year will be co-located at the Javits Center. Be talking with a whole bunch of folks there, especially looking forward to the opening panel on Wednesday morning, which will be about emergency response and has a whole bunch of some of my favorite people on it, including Howard Price, who has been on the podcast before. Looking forward to getting some of his thoughts about what's happening right now on the Gulf Coast. And as well, Alex Roman from the New York market and Jason Ornelas from out in California. So we'll be hearing from them and some other voices from the floor as well. Thursday afternoon, if you are registered at the AES convention, I will be leading a panel discussion on modern broadcast transmission facilities, and especially focusing on tall skyscraper master antenna facilities. We will have the leading voices on that from both the Empire State Building and One World Trade Center there. Should be a really good panel. And David Bialik from AES has a whole bunch of other good stuff on that track as well. We'll put a link to that on the show page for you, too, if you haven't registered yet. Not too late for you to come show up in New York for that. So much more upcoming right here on the Top of the Tower podcast. And, of course, I want to hear from you and what you think. We've had a great discussion going on already on my Facebook page the last couple of days about the whole FCC AM revitalization, a whole bunch of different voices being heard from, and we'll have much more to come. Podcast, of course, brought to you by Shively Labs. It's a division of Howell Laboratories. Shively is a proud employee-owned company with over 50 years of expert antenna and filter design and manufacturing. And brought to you by the 2019 Tower Site Calendar. It's printing, it's shipping. You can have it within just a few days in your hands when you go to the store at FiBush.com. Thanks for being with us on the Top of the Tower podcast. I'm Scott FiBush. We'll see you next week from New York City.